Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Jessica Badalana, and I'm the senior editor of Tasting Table, and it is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panelists. We have Daniel Patterson, who is the executive chef and owner of Qua in San Francisco and Plum and Haven restaurants here in the East Bay. Tanya Holland, the executive chef and owner of Brown Sugar Kitchen and the new B-Side Barbecue. And finally, Russell Moore, executive chef and owner of Camina Restaurant. Tonight, these esteemed chefs and restaurateurs will be touching on why Northern California and the East Bay are such a food destination and a particularly special place to grow, cook, and eat. Please welcome our panel. So I thought we would start with an easy question. It's always nice to warm up with an easy question. Well, maybe it's not so easy, but I'd like to know how you have seen cooking, both your own cooking and sort of cooking more broadly in the Bay Area, change in the last 5 years. And Russ, you and I were speaking about this briefly before, so I'd love to have you start off the discussion.
It's changed so much in the last 5 years. I've worked at Chez Panisse for 20 years, so that's my perspective of Bay Area cuisine from a certain point of view.
Never heard of it.
It's this place in Alameda, yeah. But a lot of restaurateurs came out of that restaurant, and that's where I learned how to cook. And it was kind of a huge influence on everything in the Bay Area. There's a lot of restaurants that are very similar or had the same ideas, and the idea of buying local organic food, I think a lot of that came from Chez Panisse. Then there was... And I guess about 5 years ago or a little bit before that, there became a little bit of a stifling element where everyone felt like every restaurant's a lot like Chez Panisse. And everywhere you go, you're going to get a beaten avocado salad, or you're going to get a goat cheese salad, or you're going to get a perfect little lettuce salad. And people got tired of that. And now, in the last 5 years, all kinds of stuff has happened. And I think it's really interesting and different and confusing and kind of wonderful. And we'll see what comes out of it at the end, but it's been a really interesting time. Now, you know, Manresa is a really influential restaurant. Qua is an influential restaurant. Similar, different, totally. You know, we all respect ingredients. We all cook a little bit differently. And then my restaurant is a lot different than Chez Panisse, too, because I worked there for so long. I know it inside and out, and, like, I'm going in a different direction as well. So I feel like there's been a ton of growth in the last 5 years. Some will stay, some won't stay. There's been a ton of growth in the world in 5 years, mm-hmm. food-wise. So who knows where it's going to go?
Daniel, what do you think? I know you travel pretty extensively, you know, and you just recently came back from the Mad Food Conference as well. Mm-hmm. How do you see it having changed since you opened Qua?
A lot. I think a lot of the things, I think one of the main things that have changed is people's appetite for risk. It was very low when we opened Qua, and I wasn't sure that we were actually going to make it. It was a very weird restaurant, it's still a weird restaurant. At the time that we opened, we were kind of viewed very skeptically. And I think what the fact that we've been able to do okay, I think in part in a few other developments has kind of, for example, Mission Chinese Food is a great example of the kind of spirit that is going on in the Bay Area right now, where something that starts as a pop-up and is kind of haphazard, and then all of a sudden it turns into a restaurant, and then it's not following a path that is kind of that was preordained or that was very common several years ago. So you have a lot of different kinds of restaurants opening and a lot of people saying, hey, maybe I can just do whatever I want to do, however that is, and it'll be okay and people will come to my restaurant. And I think that feeling it was not there that long ago, but I think it is there now.
And do you think, Tanya, that is maybe more something that you see more in the East Bay versus San Francisco? You have both of your restaurants here in the East Bay, and I know you recently looked at a space in San Francisco that ended up, sadly for me, not working out because I live over in San Francisco. But do you feel like that sort of spirit of innovation or that tolerance for risk, as Daniel said, is something that is more prevalent in the East Bay or can flourish more?
I don't know. I guess that's not as much my world because my restaurants are pretty accessible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not doing, like, you know, anything. All my food is pretty familiar to people. Mm-hmm. But what makes it unique in its genre is the ingredients that we're sourcing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that we're getting higher-end ingredients and specialty and organic and local and sustainable. And I'm seeing more restaurants around my price point mm-hmm. and my sort of level of dining, casual dining, doing that. And that's what I've seen a lot in the past 5 years, especially in Oakland. There's mm-hmm. been a lot of restaurants that have opened that are really mid-range and doing, you know, really good food that you can feel good about eating.
What are you most excited to see in the Bay Area, sort of food or restaurants? And you mentioned Mission Chinese food. What other things kind of get you fired up, either here or, you know, outside of the Bay Area? And then I guess the converse of that is, like, what do you think is kind of overrated, what has become overhyped and is maybe not, you know, not worth the high praise? You don't have to name names. I mean, you can. You <don't. laughs> Russ, we can start with you.
Controversial question. I'm excited about a lot of stuff. I mean, for the East Bay, when Comey came to the East Bay, that was a big deal. I checked a reference for a cook. I thought I would take advantage of calling James to talk to him because I never met him before, to ask about a cook that was applying for a job at my restaurant. And I said, what kind of restaurant are you doing? And he kind of explained it. And I said, wow, you are crazy. On Piedmont Avenue. That's a badass move, I think. And he took such a huge risk opening that restaurant. He had a good reputation. And he opened this in this funny little stretch. And he does great. And he killed it. And you know, he's got national press and international press. And that was a really exciting time that I think opened the door for a lot of different things. And I agree with Daniel. A lot of people are cooking the food they really want to cook. Which didn't always used to be the case. And we, at Camino, we got a ton of pressure to cook the food that everyone wanted us to cook. Mm-hmm. You should do a pizza with that oven. You should roast the chicken every night. You should have a late-night hamburger. You should do X, Y, and Z. And I really thought, I want to cook the food I want to cook. Mm-hmm. I really feel like I like restaurants where people cook the food they want to cook. Mm-hmm. Even if I don't even agree with it, I love that spirit. So that spirit's really happening. I do think... Mission Chinese. I mean, everyone went to Mission Chinese before it was famous and thought, they're crazy, they work so hard. And it was so exciting that they got so much press mm-hmm. and it blew up, because it's really good. Mm-hmm. I don't care what anyone says, I think it's really, really good. Mm-hmm. I do think there are trends in, like, national trends on how people plate and how food looks. And I think it's a lot like the 80s. Being older than some people, I have a view of this. In the 80s, there became, like, a stylistic way that people plated food. And you know, there was jokes and... Some stuff, like the Trois Gros brothers, did just amazing things, and a lot of stuff carried on from that period of time. And now, I mean, a huge influence on fancy food is Noma and kind of this Nordic cuisine, and it's awesome. But the world of Twitter and, like, instantly seeing how everyone plates that same thing, there is a style that people, when they come to my restaurant, which plates completely differently, and they want to plate in the same style, but they're not quite getting where that came from. It's an interesting point, and I think some stuff will stay. But I think not all good restaurants have to have that kind of food. You know what I mean? So, like, there's the Chez Panisse style of more rustic plating, and there's a plating style that I like that's similar to that, but kind of going in its own way. And I feel like I want restaurants to do their individual thing as mm-hmm. much as they can. And I learned a ton from going to more modern restaurants and seeing combinations of flavors that I would have never been allowed to do at Chez Panisse, ever. I mean, I knew instantly, like, what Alice would like or not like. And to me, it really opened some doors trying some food. And I thought, well, those two things go together really well, even though they're from different countries. And, you know, now I have, you know, 10 kinds of really weird herbs in my walk-in that have nothing to do with each other, except they taste really good with certain types of food once you learn how to do it. And that's totally different than it was for me.
Well, I think that you bring up sort of an interesting question about kind of expectation. And I think, you know, both, well, all of you, but, you know, in particular for this question, you know, Tanya and Daniel, I think you have two very different but interesting takes on expectation. You know, Tanya is presenting a food that's very familiar, but using, you know, ingredients that are sourced better, that taste better, with preparation that, you know, perhaps has more care than, you know, the origins of those dishes. Whereas, you know, in many cases, your dishes are, you know, very unusual flavor combinations, very unusual presentation. And so I think it's the question of, like, do you just give the diners what they want, or do you, you know, kind of try and push the envelope, you know, and how do you kind of reconcile those two and still have a successful business? Tanya Mabel?
I'm going to say, I mean, yes and no, because I definitely have, you know, the cuisines that I cook, people really, they're like, well, my grandmother made it this way. You know, they feel very propriety. And like, they're like, that's not how my grandmother did it. I'm like, well, your grandmother's dead. So, I'm like, and there's a reason why. And I've actually said this. Like, you know, I'm like, we're not cooking with a lot of animal fat. You know, we're taking care. And, you know, people come in and, well, I want to get 10 pieces of chicken to go. And I'm just like, do you see any heat lamps over there? Do you, you know, this is not Popeyes. And I have to do this constant education with people. You know, we are frying our chicken to order, and we order whole birds, so we're not getting like a case of wings. So they, you know, they all want their own pieces. But, you know, having said that, with the chicken and waffles being the bane of my existence, I didn't intend on opening a restaurant where chicken and waffles were the specialty. So I'm giving the customer what they want in that respect, is, you know, we're definitely, you know, putting out a lot of chicken and waffles and not taking off the menu, because we probably would close if we did. But I make them eat it the way that I want it prepared, you know, this is how we're doing it here. So it's kind of like, you know, you have to listen to a certain extent to your customers, but, you know, you also have to do what feels like, this is what, you know, feels good to you. And
you got to be excited about it too. You have to be excited about it, or it's not going to be that great.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what do you think, Daniel? Because I think people don't necessarily, particularly at Qua, I think, don't necessarily know what they're getting into, even reading the menu. And I mean that in a very positive sense. You know, it's a rare restaurant, I think, that you can go into and feel sort of completely disoriented in a way, and not, you know, and read the menu and not know what's going to show up.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, the element of surprises, like discovery, is one of the big parts of the restaurant. I mean, people don't come in to have the same thing they can have everywhere else, because you can get that a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just want the calories, then there's really no point in coming in. I think what's interesting, dining and the idea of happiness, I guess, is really important to me. So happiness in the restaurant, happiness with the customers, how do you get that? And then I think you start talking about expectations and expectation fulfillment, because I think at that point, so much of what makes us happy is, what do we expect? And then how much does the experience meet our expectations? So if I go and I have fried chicken, and I've had fried chicken a million times, and I've had it a million times one way exactly, then because of the way our brains work, this idea of like taste and memory and emotion all kind of glom together in this kind of prehistoric part of our brain, I'm going to get something that wasn't fried in animal fat, and instantly my brain's telling me, like, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Not like someone else is doing it different, but mm-hmm. it's wrong, I don't like it. And it's so, and I'm sure you see this, it's so immediate. And I had this experience, oh, I don't know. Maybe it was a realization I had maybe a year after we were open. I had a pasta dish. It was a perfectly fine pasta dish. Someone worked with me who had worked at an Italian place, and they said, well, that's not how it's made. And that's not how they do it in Italy. And I realized we actually can't get too close to a deeply held cultural construct, because at that point, people shut down. They don't want to see something different. They want it. At that point, it's like going so close to a magnet that the magnet just kind of absorbs it, and I can't get it off of that. So everything we do has fragments of tradition and threads of, we work with memory a lot. So my personal memory, I think about cultural memory. We make beet and goat cheese things. I like beet and goat cheese. We don't shy away from flavors.
You didn't work at Chez Panisse for 20 years.
But that's the thing. You don't have to have worked there for 20 years in order to, like, have a strong feeling. Okay, so maybe you don't have the same strong feeling that I have about it. Maybe,
they both have
maybe,
strong feelings.
Maybe you take it in a different way. But we use a lot of sprouts. We use wheatgrass. We use, like, hippie things. And then we use, like lichen and kind of wild things. And so there's this kind of, this idea of a memory of a place. You know, people have lived here for 6,000 years. We use popcorn, which, you think about it, it's like, what is a cultural memory that all of us have? It's buttered popcorn. But then, actually, in our region, you know, corn, and it's funny because I was in Mexico City and I was talking about this a lot. As cooks, we look to Europe, you know, as our training. But actually, our own continent, you know, as you go up and down, the continents that we're actually connected to, most cooks ignore it, and especially as you get to a higher price point. And the fact is, I think we need to kind of be looking south a little bit more to Mexico and Central America and South America. And you think about corn, you know, it's the most important plant up and down. But in this area, there was nomadic tribes, and they ate popcorn. There's light you can carry from place to place. So it's one of the oldest foods. And so you serve popcorn, and you know, we do something with it. But at the same time, it's something that by the end of the kind of eating it, it's something that everyone recognizes. And so it's got this multiple-tiered thing. And then expectation becomes, I recognize something. Mm-hmm. I do have something to hold on to, but I also have something that's kind of new at the same time.
Right. There are a number of questions from the audience about, not entirely surprisingly, about ingredients, about sourcing ingredients. In particular, there's one here about sort of the quagmire of sourcing seafood. There's also a question in here about sourcing ingredients from sort of outside the Bay Area. In particular, they mentioned lobster and truffles. And then a question which I think is sort of a hot button topic now, about the recent California ban on foie gras. So just for a moment, if you guys could speak about, you know, what kind of guides your sourcing and, you know, maybe where you stand on the ban.
I like to make a lot of rules for myself for sourcing because I like restrictions when I cook. I mean, I cook in a fireplace for a reason. And I have to learn how to be creative within this cooking facility that doesn't have a circulator, it doesn't have lots of ovens. And I have to find a way to make a good dinner out of that fireplace, which for me makes me more creative, and for me it's more interesting. So same with sourcing. I mean, it's really simple, and the Bay Area is really simple for me. All our vegetables are organic, period. No thing at the bottom of the menu that says sometimes when we can, or if it's not too difficult, or the weather's not bad. I mean, that's really not even a difficult thing at all. And then we buy local fish not for sustainability reasons, but we buy local fish because I think when you travel, you go to Mexico, you don't order salmon. You know, you go to Hawaii, you don't really want Alaskan halibut. Great fish, and some of them are really sustainably caught. And for my restaurant, I want it to be a Bay Area restaurant. So I have these little imagined borders that I order fish from, and then within that, I try to decide how it's caught, how well it's doing, with as much information as I can get, and it's really, really hard, and it changes weekly, and it's arguments with the fish market. And so we may have ling cod for a really long time, for stretches of time, and sardines and squid, stuff I really like, and then once in a while, California sea bass. Moved from San Diego, and it's in the Bay Area, and then we're super excited, and we buy it every single day until it's gone, then it's gone. And then we're excited that, you know, next year might come back. Might not. You know, and this year we had salmon.
What's a sort of average consumer to do? Because, I mean, here you are very savvy about, you know, who to call, what to ask. You know, what's a normal person supposed to do? You're like, what's a normal person?
You don't have to eat meat. You don't have to eat fish necessarily. If you want to, if it's something you're concerned with, then you should do. I think a little studying wouldn't hurt.
You mean for shopping or for dining?
For shopping.
Yeah.
I think a little studying wouldn't hurt. I mean, I think some people take the Monterey Bay Aquarium card and look at that. And to me, it's too broad a stroke, and it doesn't talk about individual fishermen and what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So for me, that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But I went for really a long time without having any meat that I didn't know exactly where it came from in my own life, which was here. It's pretty easy to do. There's lots of vegetables to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's up to you how far you want to dig. I feel a extra responsibility because I'm a restaurateur, you know, and I came from this other restaurant that had a reputation for buying stuff, and I was a produce buyer there. And then at my restaurant, like, I'm not going to play around. I'm not going to bend the rules. But you don't need to at all here. It's so easy. I don't live in a different place. It's so easy here. Mm-hmm. But you could just not eat meat, I think.
Tanya, what do you think about the foie gras ban?
Well, I was in New York about a month ago, and I had foie gras. I was very excited. I don't know. You know, having trained in France, I'm just, you know, I don't know. I just think it's just the way it is, you know. The foie gras is a food that we've been enjoying for years, and I don't really have any, I'm not like a animal humanely, you know, person who has, like, strong opinions about that, except for, you know, that they're fed well, like the beef and the pork that we buy. And I think the ducks that were raised here were fed well. You know, I don't think the process, I don't really have anything against that. So, yeah, I don't know. It's unfortunate.
You know, I'd be interested about sourcing.
But I don't use foie gras in my restaurant,
right.
So,
yeah.
You know, how much, you know, talking about expectations, and I think, you know, you're talking about 5 years. Like, I think people's, the diner's expectations have changed a lot, like, all up and down the scale about what they're going to get and the quality of ingredients. How much have you seen that change?
Well, you know, we started from the beginning with really good ingredients and listing on the menu, you know, that we get Fulton Valley fryers and use organic clover, dairy, things like that. And I think now our customers are really appreciating that. And I see it at other new restaurants that are open, that they call that out. And I think, you know, people are just noticing it.
Well, and then there's the, you know, sort of thorn in everyone's side, the question that comes up of, you know, it's too expensive. It's too expensive to eat well. You know, and food costs, with the drought in the Midwest, you know, there's a lot of, actually, it's an interesting point that there's a lot of talk about how the price of corn is going to go up, and in turn, the price of corn-fed beef may also go up. And so finally, there may be a bit of a balance between pasture-raised animals and corn-fed animals. But I think, you know, there's this idea that good food is fancy, that it's not accessible, that you have to be wealthy, you know. And I think it's, you know, it's sort of the one of the main arguments, it seems, against, you know, sort of shopping at the farmer's market. It's too expensive.
Good food is only expensive if you don't know how to cook. I mean, if all you can do is throw a steak on the grill, you're going to end up paying a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of different parts of the animal, and they're not hard to cook. You throw them in some liquid, and you let it go for a while in the oven, and sooner or later it's tender, and then you can eat it. I mean, you know.
With your popcorn.
Well,
I think.
Not at the same time necessarily, but yeah.
Also, we're more about educating our customers. You know, if they come to our restaurant, they don't expect a Southern soul food or barbecue place to have as high-end ingredients and higher prices. Just saying, like, it's because we're using these good ingredients, and this is what you should be eating and looking for yourself. And so, for me, it's just like, you know, because we're in West Oakland, so our customers are coming from West Oakland, they're coming from Piedmont, they're coming from this area, from San Francisco, everywhere, but just making it accessible in the neighborhoods we're in, I think is, you know, letting people know that it's important to have, you know, eat a higher quality of food and pay more. You know, you'll feel better in the end. People say that to us all the time, like, wow, I just, like, I feel good after I eat your food.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the, you know, sort of the question or the idea of neighborhoods and, you know, what it is to be a restaurant in neighborhoods in Oakland. I know you also have a restaurant in San Francisco, but for the sake of this question, to think about, you know, the places that you have here, you know, sort of in the East Bay, and how those have shaped the neighborhoods in which they are located. You know, just sort of what sort of responses, both kind of positive and negative, have you gotten, you know, opening restaurants in areas where there really weren't any? I mean, certainly your latest project, Haven, is in an area that is, you know, not known for a bustling restaurant community in West Oakland. You know, you have to drive a ways to get to your place. It's sort of a hidden gem. And you were just saying that, you know, you can go the stretch of Grand that your restaurant is on for quite some time before you, you know, hit another restaurant.
Between my restaurant and Charlie's restaurant, there's nine nail salons. Which is a fine business, but nine seems kind of a lot.
So, yeah, Russ, tell us sort of, you know, as a kind of pioneer of that end of Grand, you know, what have you heard, what have you hear from the neighbors when you opened?
They were super excited when we were building it out. I think a lot was tied to you know, there's a couple articles written because I was leaving my chef's job at Chez Panisse and opening a restaurant in Oakland instead of San Francisco, and people were really, really excited. I think it's my restaurant's a little bit of a confusing restaurant from where I am at times. I think it doesn't feel fancy in traditional fancy ways, but our prices aren't super cheap, and we don't wear uniforms, and there's all kinds of things that I think some people in that area maybe associate with a fine dining experience. A white tablecloth, a waiter with a tie. That took a while for people to get used to that that aspect. But it's still funny. There's still people that live in three blocks away in Piedmont who have never been to Camino, and we're trying to do everything we can to like let them step in. Like, we want to take care of you and make you some really good food. It's not that weird, you know. Mm-hmm. And our food, I mean, compared to what the things that Daniel's doing at Qua, it's not weird at all. It's regular food, but... Yeah, I don't mean. I mean,
we should
you're,
say maybe unusual.
No, well, I think Daniel's pushing boundaries in a lot of ways, and I think our boundaries are different. You know, mm-hmm. It still is chicken with a certain thing. People really, I don't know, really wanted us to make pizza, though. Really, yeah. really wanted us to make pizza, and I really didn't want to make pizza. So Charlie opened Boot and Shoe, and that was an instant success. And really, like, they can get their head around that. Here's a place that's like not too expensive. It's kind of cool. There's a bar and there's pizza, and our restaurant has a lot of vegetables. And you know, yesterday we had five weird herbs that I know no one ever heard of before, but we kind of snuck them in simple little dishes. And there's, you know, myrtle and anisissip and lovage. And slowly we get the people that really are appreciating that we're shooting for this other little thing, and the neighborhood's really come around. It's been really great. It's been a slower progress than I would have liked in the beginning, like 2008, if you remember what happened in 2008. But I think 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, 30 years down the line, our restaurant's like building this community around us, which I really, really like. We had regulars in the first week that are still there. Hmm. And then we have the occasional Japanese tourists who stopped in once, and every time they're in California, they come by our restaurant. It's like all ranges, you know. So hopefully the place next to us opens a restaurant again, and, you know, some other places open to kind of wake up the street up. But Oakland's so diverse and crazy, you know.
Well, and so what did Brown Sugar Kitchen do to West Oakland? And what is, I don't, what what's the neighborhood that B-Side is in?
Same neighborhood.
Is it
yeah,
still
it's
West
five
Oakland?
Five blocks away.
So yeah, what have those restaurants done to West Oakland? Or what has West Oakland done to those restaurants?
I guess. Well, I think, you know, I always tell people that the location and the space dictates the concept. Believe it or not, I mean, when I was looking for restaurant space, 6 or 7 years ago, I was going to do sort of an upscale Creole bistro. I always liked the bistro concept for restaurants, and I wasn't really seeing any of those mid-range places in the Bay Area that, you know, I really wanted to go to that weren't, like, completely French. But I wasn't able to find a lease or a space that was suitable, or, you know, the landlords said, well, you've never owned a restaurant before, even though I had been in the business for over 20 years. And the space, my husband and I moved to the neighborhood in 2005, and that was really the only thing we could find to buy at that time. And saw the space down the street and realized there was an underserved community there. I had to get in my car to go get a cup of coffee. There was no place to get a bite that was decent, that wasn't, you know, yeah, not even, like, anything. So I just went in there thinking, like, okay, we'll do some baked goods. I'll do the Southern influence, and maybe I'll do some catering out of here. You know, six burners, a flat top, and a fryer that's only used for beignets. And then I bought a waffle maker, and then it all went, you know, crazy. But the way it's really affected the neighborhood is that there seems to be more neighborhood pride now. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are like, oh, yeah, I live in that neighborhood where Brown Sugar mm-hmm. Kitchen is, because there are some mm-hmm. residents. But there's also a lot of industrial, commercial, kind of businesses over there. And a lot of people would use the Mandela Parkway as a thoroughfare and just drive by. And there wasn't a lot of walking traffic. So now we're seeing a lot more people walking on mm-hmm. the parkway. We're seeing people stop on their way to Emeryville to shop mm-hmm. and spending money in Oakland. And coming to that neighborhood, it's been great.
And Daniel, what has it been like to be sort of a pioneer in that Jack London neighborhood? Because development. Because there was a lot of promise of many businesses opening there, and
I remember that.
and you sort of ended up being kind of.
I was supposed to be there too.
I also looked out.
We're not going to talk about that.
But you have. I mean, you proceeded with opening the restaurant, sort of last man slash first man standing. And what has that been like?
I mean, it's been great. It's actually the most successful restaurant we've ever opened. What's interesting, it's 20 blocks away from Plum. Plum is like, that uptown area is like a no man's land right now, in terms of it's not really a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And it's a neighborhood in transition, but it's not fully evolved yet. So we have the theaters. We have, you know, these rushes of activity on a first Friday. You can see the potential. And there's this great spirit in the air and everyone's out and about. You know, on the face of it, it seems like opening in the corner, and not the front corner, the back corner that you can't see from the street of an empty building in a part of town that no one goes to, where every other retail shop has now closed.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it was busy like the day we opened. And part of it, I think, is because our chef is really talented. Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, I don't cook in the East Bay, so I mean, I'm only a chef at Qua. Mm-hmm. But I think that what we were... Plum was a little bit more edgier concept. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that is really important. If you want to talk about expectation, like, we listen to our customers a lot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we go in a neighborhood, we think, okay, well, what are we doing right? What are we not doing right? And then we allow the business to evolve to hit a midway place with our customers. Because at the end of the day, if you just do whatever you want to do and you ignore everyone who's coming in, it's not much of a business. It's not much, you know, because you're cooking for people. So what we're trying to do is, in a way, do something with integrity, but also something that has meaning to the people around us. And so what we found at Haven is there is a community there. I mean, if you go to Blue Bottle 2 blocks away, there's a line constantly. I don't know where they come from. Everyone like materializes out of the sidewalk. But every day we're busy. But I think, like I said, a lot of it has to do with our chef, Kim Alter, who's amazing.
And we were discussing, before the program started, I don't know if any of you saw the New York Times article about the top 45 places to visit, you know, now. And Oakland was number 5 on that list.
In between Tokyo and London.
In between Tokyo and London. And I think there was sort of like a collective high-fiving amongst Oakland businesses and people that live in the East Bay. And we were just sort of discussing, like, is that hype? Well, I don't want to call it hype, but, you know, was that premature? Is it premature to call Oakland one of the top 5 places in the world to visit? And I was, you know, I'm interested because I think people that live in the communities and people that have businesses in the communities are the first ones to want a boost for the community. I mean, you were saying that you were tapped to be on the Oakland...
Visit Oakland.
Yeah. But is that... Does that sort of bear out? Is it a top 5 place in the world?
I love Oakland, and I love the community in Oakland, and I love our staff, and I love our customers. Top 5 right now? No, not yet. Mm. I think, you know, an example of that is my business slows down in the summer because tourists don't come to Oakland.
Because we have no hotels.
Mm. There's no hotel. Absolutely. There's not a hotel you can say, oh, go to this hotel. So we're much busier when everyone's in town and, you know, coming
so
to our
place. So if anyone wants to open some boutique hotels, be great.
Yeah, if there was an Ace Hotel in Oakland, it would do great.
Exactly.
Yeah, it would be awesome, and people might come here. But we're not quite, we don't have the infrastructure yet to say this is a great destination at that level. I would say if you're going to come here and try some cool restaurants and, like, see some stuff and then travel around a little bit, yeah. But I think that was premature. I mean, I loved seeing it, of course, because I want Oakland. I mean, I'm always going to be in Oakland, so that's pretty exciting, but I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, this is the longest. I've lived in Oakland longer than I've lived anywhere. And I've lived in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Paris, you know, France, some in Burgundy area, Boston. I've been all over this country, and it is by far my favorite place in the world. I mean, I just, to live, it's just, I love the diversity, love the weather. You know, the food offerings are great. Like, I can only live so far away from Berkeley Bowl. Like, I'll never move any farther away from Berkeley Bowl than I do live. So I don't know. I think, yeah, it's kind of hard to say because we know a lot of the issues that the city has and, you know, a lot of challenges. Say, is it top 5? But I'm very proud to show people around, you know, the city when they come visit.
And then have them sleep on the floor of your house because right. there are no hotels in
there. Yeah, right, or suggest they stay in Emeryville or something like that. Yeah, unfortunately, that is. But I was going to say, we do get a lot of destination diners, and I think that's, you know, something that definitely is great in the East Bay especially. There's so many different neighborhoods that are spread out that people will travel for good food. And then we get a lot of people from out of town, and our location might be more conducive to that because we're kind of on the outskirts of town, so mm-hmm. we're just over the bridge mm-hmm. on the way to the airport, thoroughfare kind of way. But
well, and a kind of related, somewhat related question, you know, you're sort of seeing now that boroughs or, you know, the sort of bedroom communities of big cities are becoming, not becoming, have become sort of hotbeds of culinary innovation, creativity, and you've seen it in Brooklyn, you see it in Decatur, you know, outside of Atlanta. I think you're seeing it, you know, in Oakland, and of course, some of that has to do with, you know, the economics of it. But I think we were saying earlier that Brooklyn is not affordable anymore, and so I wonder, you know, is there sort of more to it than that? Are there other reasons, bigger reasons? That you know, that people are opening in the boroughs. What do you think?
I mean, Oakland's a real city. It's not a borough. I think everyone says we're Brooklyn, kind of 10 years behind, 5 years, whatever. There are some similarities. Yeah, well, there are some similarities. But I think at the end of the day, it's when we open our restaurants, we opened them for people who live in Oakland. I live in Oakland. So, you know, we didn't think, okay, this is going to be a tourist destination. And I think that everyone who's going into Oakland now that I've talked to more or less has the same idea. Whereas you go to San Francisco, it's more likely you'll go to San Francisco to make something for a tourist clientele. And so what I like about Oakland is people are very honest, you know, and you don't talk about plating styles. People don't care about plating styles here. They care if the food tastes good. And so I think I'm not really a kind of hyper, a lot of the trends that go on, I'm kind of, but I care about what the food tastes like. And so you talk about ingredients, you talk about all of these things. You know, at the end of the day, like, is there a concentration of flavor? Is there balance? Does it taste delicious? And so, I think the people that are coming to Oakland are people, what I've noticed, which I absolutely love, is that there's a lot of integrity about, you know, forget about what it looks like. Is it delicious? How did you make it? Where did your ingredients come from? They go right to it. And so you get, like, people going to the farmers markets on one-speed bicycles, you know, those things with no brakes, and, you know, and they'll spend all of their money to get, like, really good ingredients, you know, and they'll take them home. You know, I talk to the guys who I buy, like, basically all of our beef from, Prado Ranch, and they're at a couple of the farmers markets. They're like, Oakland is, like, we have the most consistent and loyal clientele in a lot of regards. So I think if you look at people who are making preserves, people who, like Hodo Soy, if you look at Blue Bottle, who has their plant here, like so many of the places that are opening up really have a lot of integrity to them. And I think that's something that the city can really build from, because they're not coming in to say, let's do something splashy. They're coming in to say, let's do something real and good.
I want to follow up on that thought in just a moment, but first I wanted to remind everyone that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our panelists today are Daniel Patterson, executive chef and owner of Qua, Plum, and Haven Restaurants, Tanya Holland, executive chef and owner of Brown Sugar Kitchen and B-Side BBQ, and Russell Moore, executive chef and owner of Camino Restaurant, and I'm Jessica Badalana, senior editor of Tasting Table. We had a brief discussion before the program began, and Russell and Tanya were both positing that, in fact, the East Bay diner may be more discriminating than the San Francisco diner. And Russell, in particular, you said something that I thought was interesting, because when you and your wife were looking at restaurant spaces 6 years ago,
We started looking seven years ago.
You had your sights set on San Francisco, and you said, you know, there was a meal that made you decide to open in the East Bay.
we were looking in San Francisco because we thought that would be easier or more people would be receptive to what we're doing. And we looked and looked and looked and couldn't find what we wanted, and it was getting really frustrating. And then we had one meal at a restaurant that's a really good restaurant. It doesn't matter what restaurant it is. But we walked in, Allison looked at me and said, you know, I don't want a restaurant. I don't want to have a restaurant. If this is what a restaurant is, this is not what I want. And what she was saying was, everyone was the same age, or between 25 and 35, white. The men were wearing a certain kind of stripy shirt. The women were wearing a certain kind of dress. They were drinking a certain kind of cocktail that looked exactly the same. And it was a sea of people with disposable income going to a restaurant because that's what you do with... It wasn't in the marina. That's the thing. It was like, it was a restaurant that we all go to. And I thought, I don't know what has gotten into my head that this is not where I want to be. And you go to Oakland and, you know, our waiters say it all the time because a lot of them have worked in the city. And they say, we have the nicest crowd around. And they're different. They're sometimes super difficult about ingredients and where it came from and how the fish was caught and who caught and, you know, how the pig was killed and all that kind of stuff. And I could talk about that all day, obviously. But, our crowd is young and old and black and white and Asian and Mexican, and so are our servers and so are our cooks, and it's totally different. It's a different feel. You know, people dress up or not dress up. Half the people ride their bikes there. You know, we had a wedding at a restaurant. Everyone rode their bikes there. I love that. You know, and that's, the East Bay felt totally different. I mean, there's like economy issues as well. I mean, I have a big space for the restaurant I want to do, and I actually put less seats in than I could fit in because I didn't want to cook too much food out of my hearth that I couldn't do right. Mm-hmm. And I could do that in Oakland. You know, I have a gigantic fireplace. In the city, that would have broke the bank, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different feel, and I'm really happy that we made that decision. It's not always easy because people go to bed really early. Yeah. But it's the right one for us, you know.
And Daniel, what do you think? I mean, being the one person on the panel tonight that has restaurants on both sides, you know, what do you, like, how does the clientele differ? I mean, I'm sure it's a little difficult because they're different styles of restaurant as well, but...
I mean, 100% agree. I mean, I know the kind of clientele in a casual restaurant in San Francisco and the kind of clientele in a casual, like Plum is a casual restaurant to me. Camino is a casual restaurant. I mean, they're all, you know, I wouldn't open Qua in Oakland. I don't mm-hmm. think there's the customer base for it. I'm not even sure there's a customer base in San Francisco. I think there's 4 million people in the Bay Area, and I'm still not sure that that's, like, enough customer base for what we do. Mm-hmm. But you know, I remember when we opened at Plum, it was one of the few times I spent in the kitchen, and right when we opened, I looked out over everyone who was eating there, and the place was full, and it was exactly what you were saying. And I was like, this is awesome, because everyone was having a good time. No one cared about who was sitting next to them. They cared about that they were having a good time. They cared about what was on their plate, what they were drinking, and they cared about each other. Mm. And that was like, there's an energy that doesn't, I don't see very much mm-hmm. in the city.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you can expand without sort of losing the kind of heart of your enterprise? I mean, Tanya, you just opened a second restaurant, and you had looked at opening a third restaurant. You know, how do you do that sort of gracefully?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm still, like, trying to figure out how these people who have, like, multiple restaurants in different parts of the area, the world, you know, the country, do that. Like I said, I'm lucky our restaurants are just a few blocks from each other, so I'm in each one every day, several times a day. Mm-hmm. And I hire people who I feel have the same values that I do and, you know, and withhold our standards, and that's, you know, that's how I do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think that, this is sort of a related question, but that, you know, there's sort of the idea of the celebrity chef now, you know, that has books and television shows and, you know, restaurants all over the world. You know, sort of with the advent of these celebrity chefs, you know, what do you think about people that kind of build a brand versus, you know, stay in their restaurant day in, day out?
Can't you do both?
I don't know. That's a good question. Can you do both?
I think, I mean, it's very individual. It depends on who's on your team, you know, and and how much money you have, really. It takes a lot of money to do those kind of things. But really it depends on who's supporting you, you know, whether it's a publicist and just what kind of person you are, you know, how much you can take on and do at once and what your goals are. Some people are really happy being in the kitchen. All they want to do is cook. You know, I feel like I'm more of the entrepreneurial person. I like looking at the big picture and creating the environment and finding the right people to serve and that kind of thing, like just all the different elements of the business. So I think it just depends on, you know, what kind of, you know, personality you have. Yeah.
But I think there's something else to it, too, which you asked kind of about, you know, what's been going on the last couple of years. And one of the things that's pretty exciting is there's a lot of young cooks that are doing really interesting food. Now in the city, a lot of those guys, I mean, they work for me. And so now they go off and they're a chef somewhere else. I'd like them to be a chef in my own restaurant. So if I open a restaurant mm-hmm. and provide an opportunity, I think it's exactly what you're talking about. It's about team. And so for me, like I have really good people running the Oakland places, and I don't really have much to do with it. You know, so I'm a chef in one place, and it's really kind of a full-time job on its own. Mm-hmm. But opening more restaurants, I think, sometimes is really about providing more opportunity and getting people and training them. And then you're like, okay, well, you're ready for the next step. What can I do to kind of provide that next step? And there's really a nice win-win there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the thing you can really do for your chef or your sous chef or someone who worked for you forever and kind of send them off in a good way. I mean, we only have one restaurant, but... And the way our restaurant works, it's super individual. It's super me in the mm-hmm. fireplace. I can't see someone else running my restaurant, mm-hmm. really. But mm-hmm. if there was some other casual thing that someone that worked for me who is really smart and was really going to go for it, I could see that. I mean, I'm super control freak in my restaurant for forever. But I've seen a lot of successful people open little places and done well. Like James opened Hawker Fair. Mm-hmm. It was... super personal to him, and he has a chef running in, and it works really well. And you have Kim running Haven. It's this like Mario Batali model of like he gives his chef a piece of the action, and they open a new restaurant. I think that's pretty cool. I'm nervous to do it myself. Who knows what would happen in the future? But I think it's a good thing to do for your people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, now that there's sort of, I think in general in the Bay Area, you know, the level of knowledge and you know, and sophistication about food has certainly increased in the last decade, which in general I would say is probably a good thing. But the downside of it, I think, is that, you know, in sort of the age of the internet, everyone's got an opinion and everyone's got, an email address or internet access. So how do you...
And a camera.
And a camera, yeah, exactly. So with, like, all the sort of noise in the system, you know, with the Yelp reviews, with, you know, with all of that, sort of the blogs, this, that, the other thing, you know, how do you kind of, like, I guess, does that affect the way that you do your business? Do you read that stuff? Do you not read that stuff?
I read it if I'm feeling bad. Sometimes I'll read Yelp just to really just drive it home. I mean, ever since I was called Stalin in Yelp, I thought I should keep reading this. I'm gonna like keep it going until I'm Pol Pot. You know, I really want to I just want to see like how bad is it gonna be. You can't. I mean, I read that stuff just because I'm curious what people say about the restaurant, and I want people to have a good time. And there might be a thread that goes through that might have some truth in it that is interesting. Like if, you know, 25 people say that things are too salty, I'm going to check on that and think things are getting a little salty. And that's an interesting thing, but you can't take it too seriously. You can't really take it home with you. I mean, it's just crazy. If you have a restaurant with an opinion, you're going to get people who have an opinion too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some are good and some are bad. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of how it is. I don't think we're going to win any awards amongst Yelp as, like, the greatest restaurant or anything. But, we decided to open a restaurant that was going to be, you have to commit, you know. We didn't want a restaurant that was, yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, I like it. It's all right. I wanted a restaurant that was, people loved it, or maybe hated it. Mm-hmm. But mostly loved it, hopefully, you know. And you read that stuff, and it makes you want to go to the middle and toe this some certain line. I think that's the worst thing you could possibly do.
Sure.
I think you just lose your integrity and everything.
And I think we've all seen that in restaurants that, you know, eventually end up closing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's just sort of the death knell. It's like the first thing they do is, like, you know, put a burger on the menu, and then the next thing they do is, like, you know, serve pizza after 11. You know, whatever it is, yeah. they get further and further, I think, from, you know, from their own original vision. And I think, you know, one of the admirable things about you, Daniel, and about Kwa is, you know, you hear you are saying, like, there's 4 million people. I don't know if it's enough, but, like, what the hell? This is what I want to do. And I think there's something, you know, really honorable about doing what you want to do, even though there are going to be, certainly there are going to be critics, because you're not doing something that's palatable to everyone.
I don't know if it's honorable. It's a little dumb. Because I actually do know how to make money. We could open a pizzeria. Mm-hmm. We'd make really good pizza. Mm-hmm. And we could open a burger joint, and I'm not saying that we won't someday. I might say, okay, you know, kids are getting older, and, you know, we're going to put them into college, and maybe it's time to start, you know, getting rid of all of these ideas. But, you know, I mean, Kwa is like, I mean, as a business person, as a cook. We've evolved a lot, but we've never changed our identity. We've clarified it over time. So now it's like the focus on a lens. It's gotten more and more clear. And I agree. It's like some people like it and some people don't. And it's, but we work very hard at reaching people and making food that's delicious that people are going to like. And we don't always succeed, but we really try. I think the idea that there's like kind of one or the other, I don't think that's really right. I think some people have a way of expressing themselves that's more, for lack of a better word, mainstream, and some, for lack of a better word, weirder. So I have a weirder, I mean, it's just that, but that's who I am. So to do something different would be to do something that was not me, but that's also why I'm not the chef of any other restaurant.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, the dining scene in Oakland, people really want that authenticity. They want to feel that the person, you know, that this is your vision, this is what you're doing, and you're just presenting the authentic you and your food. You can't, you know, play any games or pretend to.
Yeah, you won't last long in the East Bay if you're just trying to fake it.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
There's an interesting question from the audience, and we very briefly kind of started to discuss this, and I would like to I'll ask this question, and then if there are members of the audience who would like to line up at the microphone to ask questions, I would like to invite you to do that now while I ask this next question. The question is that previously, you know, in past decades, higher-end restaurants in the United States tried to emulate the cuisine of Europe. You know, it was always looking to Europe. It was looking to France. It was looking to Italy, you know, and sort of that idea of continental food. Do you think that the tide has turned, and do you think that people in Europe and Asia and, you know, elsewhere in the world are now kind of looking to California for trends, for ideas, for inspiration?
No. I think California, in the United States right now, the Bay Area is probably the most exciting place to cook and the place to eat, hands down. And I think, you know, you can argue about it, but you'd be wrong. It's just right now, all the way up and down the ladder, in terms of ingredients, in terms of personality in the food, in terms of integrity, in terms of people pushing the envelope. I don't know, there's a review in the New York Times, and people made a, like, kind of an offhand comment, if you want experimental food, go to Chicago or San Francisco. How the hell did this happen?
Right.
Right? Whoever would have saw that coming? But, you know, around the world, honestly, no. I mean, the America generally is still kind of regarded as the backwards cousin that you don't want to spend too much time talking to at the party because, you know, they're not too bright. It's definitely changing, but like pinpoints to them, like pinpoints of light in a vast darkness. And so that's a perceptual thing rather than kind of reality, because the reality is that there is stuff going on.
I think it's more individuals and their individual restaurants. Mm. I mean, I think just access to... I have people contacting me from really far off places wanting to look at the fireplace and cook in the fireplace, mm-hmm. for that specific thing, mm-hmm. not because the Bay Area has X, Y, or Z or anything like that. And, you know, we all see the same pictures of food from Tokyo or Korea or, you know, it's instant. You can see, like, oh, that restaurant seems fascinating to me and I really want to go to that restaurant. I think that's happening more. I mean, I'm not, and I don't travel as much as Daniel and I haven't seen as much out of the world, but I look at my little computer at night sometimes and you can see, like, oh, stuff's really happening in Korea. You know, yeah. I'm Korean, so I'm super excited about that. Yeah. But I think it's individual restaurants, individual people doing things that is changing.
Well, and then this last year, I dubbed something the Noma effect. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Noma, the restaurant in Copenhagen. And it's been hugely, it won a number of awards, was rated the best restaurant in the world by the San Pellegrino list. And, you know, you have seen sort of the ripplings of what that restaurant has done, you know, all over the food scene, from here to New York to Paris. You know, all of a sudden, you know, dishes start turning up that you think, huh, I think I saw that in the Noma cookbook. You know, and so I think it's, my point is kind of that you never know where the next spot will be that will kind of draw such fervor, I think. You know, maybe
it'll
be Oakland.
It'll be here.
It's going to be Oakland. Okay. Or Lafayette. Well, maybe. did anyone have a question before I continue? I have plenty more to ask, but I want to give everyone the chance. No? Yeah, you want to step up to the mic so we can all hear you?
Hi.
Serious. He has a notebook, you guys.
I see the notebook.
Yeah, watch
out.
What you say. You just mentioned Lafayette. I'm just wondering about your thoughts on this side of the hills, the dining scene in Lafayette, Walnut Creek, and if you any of you had given any thought to opening up a restaurant over here.
You seen the traffic in that tunnel?
I'm kind of stuck in where I am in Oakland, and to go this far any direction, I wouldn't go to San Francisco either. For me, I don't know the dining scene out here right now. I just like my little community. I'm sticking with that. It doesn't mean it's good or bad or anything. I just don't know.
I'll agree with that. Yeah, I really like, you know, we considered going to San Francisco or other locations, and there's just something nice about having this little radius, mm-hmm. you know, for us. Works really well.
Mm-hmm. I think also, for me, Oakland is, there's so much still to be done, and so much we want to do with our restaurants to grow them and maybe open more restaurants, so much in the community itself that it's hard to imagine having the energy on top of that to go into a new community and learn about a, right. you know, a new group of people.
Yes. Anyone else have a question?
Thank you all so much for coming. My question is, if you didn't have the opportunity to work in the Bay Area, what other area, maybe other than New York, because that's kind of obvious, but where in the country would you work?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think Mexico is super interesting. Hawaii could be super interesting. I think there's a need for...
Russ likes to surf, so
I don't actually surf anymore, but surfing, the idea that I could surf if I had a day off would be exciting. But I think that, you know, I know some organic farmers in Hawaii, and I think that'd be an interesting place to have a restaurant. So many interesting people there, and it's always thought of as like, oh, it's a horrible place for food in a certain way. But I know some cool farmers, which if there's cool farmers, there could be a cool restaurant. I mean, I think that's all it takes, mm-hmm. really. But I don't know. I'm not going anywhere, but that'd be interesting.
Theoretically, yeah. Hypothetically.
I would probably work somewhere on the Eastern Seaboard just because I really love East Coast seafood, and I worked over in that area before. And
you grew up on the East Coast, yeah?
Yeah, I'm from upstate New York, mm-hmm. but I worked at Martha's Vineyard for a few summers, and it was just great, like, getting fish that was caught that day and... I mean,
we're
going
to have to talk about this, because so did I.
Definitely.
Where are Martha's Vineyard? The Harborview Hotel. When I was like 14, 15, 16.
Yeah. I worked at L'Etoile, also in Eckertown, at the Charlotte Inn, which is a Relais & Chateau. And I worked at the Oyster Bar, which doesn't exist anymore. That was in Oak Bluffs. And The Sweet Life, which still does exist, and another restaurant up island, which does not exist anymore.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have, if nobody else in the audience has another question, I have another question, which is just sort of something I'm curious about. What is your, what's your favorite ingredient to cook with right now?
I'll answer that. I would, right now, fresh garbanzo beans, only because, I mean, this is some minutia that I don't know if anyone really cares about, but last year was a really bad garbanzo year. And there's a lot of discussions with me and Maria Catalan about what happened with the garbanzo beans. And we talked about it for 9 months leading up, and I got my first case, and it was just great. That, and we have neighbors who are growing every weird herb I ever wanted and supplying us with honey. So, you know, lovage, anise, hyssop, whatever. I mean, we have everything I've ever wanted right now, herb-wise, growing. But green garbanzos, that's
well,
where it's
I
at.
The audience here, when you said green garbanzos, everyone went, oh, like you said, you know, bacon or chocolate or something. Like, yeah. You know you're in the right place when the crowd oohs and ahs for green garbanzos. What about you, Tanya? Favorite ingredient right now?
Oh, boy, let me think. I just always love cornmeal. I'm pretty traditionalist with, you know, the things I cook with are my repertoire of ingredients within the concepts I'm working in can't get too wild, you know, for price reasons, and also it's just, you gotta kind of stay focused within your concept, you know. So anything with cornmeal at this time of year, just adding fresh corn to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I don't have a most. I get excited about everything. I mean, so right now is like everything's kind of exploding. Piquillo peppers are coming. I'm excited about that. That'll happen in a few weeks. So many different things. But at home, we grow a lot of herbs, and now is the time when they're all starting to flower. You know, say like the anise hyssop and a lot of like. Different kinds of mints, and so that's kind of great. And so typically when I start the day, I'll pick some things from the garden and some flowers and stuff, and then get a few other things along the way, and then go into the restaurant. And so that's always really nice when the season shifts that way.
And my last question before we conclude for the evening is one restaurant everyone should go to right now.
Wow.
In the East Bay?
Anywhere.
Theirs?
Yeah. Very politic.
Excluding ours, but yes. I really wanted to go to Issa in Brooklyn, and before my friend got fired from there. It was the restaurant I really, really, really wanted to go to, and then, but I wouldn't go there now.
I don't want to say, because I don't want everybody to start going there, then I can't get in there, which is what people always say about my restaurant. They're like, well, I don't want to tell anyone, because then they can't go in there. But we have really been enjoying Haven lately.
No.
I don't know if you ever heard of it.
No.
yeah, it's been there twice in the past couple weeks. It's great.
Daniel, we have 1 minute. What's your go-to?
It depends on what kind of experience you want. It's such a terrible answer. I'm
going to
give you a couple. Can I give you a couple?
Well, you have 1 minute.
Okay. In 1 minute, I'm going to say Rich Table, which just opened in San Francisco. It was my chef de cuisine almost 3 years. It's really inspired, but not too expensive. And my
is
other
that
kind
R-I-T-C-H?
Of R-I-C-H.
R-I-C-H.
Yeah,
okay.
Last
I want to go
name.
There, too.
Okay. And so really excited about that. And also another guy who's worked with me, Outerlands, Brett Cooper. And I think those are super fun and for kind of more expensive, Bennu.
So now you guys have your go-to list. I see people are taking notes. You're very smart. Well, I want to thank our panel for joining us tonight, for braving the tunnel. I, of course, also want to thank the audience here. It's nice to see a packed house on a Monday night, so thank you for coming. And also our audiences on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Jessica Badalana, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.